So, first of all, let me thank the organizers very much for inviting me to this very inspiring meeting. Well, in this talk, I would like to, first of all, give you a very brief introduction to the general ideas of what asymptotic safety is, what it means to non-perturbatively quantize gravity along these lines. And then in the second part of the talk, I would like to tell you something about some more recent work we did on possible implications of this particular high energy behavior of gravity in cosmology. So to start with, perhaps it's worthwhile to compare the situation in gravity with the other fundamental forces in nature. We know the electromagnetic weak and strong interaction nowadays nicely combined into the standard model of particle physics. They have a beautiful classical structure, Yang-Mills. They are all of the Yang-Mills type with a nice geometry behind them. And we also know, at least within perturbation theory, how to convert these classical theories into some sort of quantum theory. Now, in gravity, at the classical level, the situation is similar. We have classical general relativity, a beautifully geometric theory, but the same set of recipes which work so well here, namely perturbative quantum field theory, seems not to work or only partly work in the case of gravity. That is to say, and that was repeatedly emphasized at this meeting, of course, it leads to a perturbatively non-renormalizable theory. Namely, if you base a sort of standard quantum field theory upon the Einstein-Hilbert action, expand about flat space, then what you soon discover is that an increasing order in your loop expansion parameters, say, leads to the necessity of an increasing number of counterterms, and as a consequence of that, to an increasing number of undetermined parameters. So as we heard already, quantized general relativity makes sense as an effective field theory. It's meaningful to compute quantum corrections as long as you stay at some low energy scale, but when you go up to higher energies, then most probably you will have an infinite number of undetermined parameters. So I said this is the result of applying the standard perturbative quantization scheme, which we apply to the standard model also. So it's perhaps worthwhile to analyze in some more detail what this standard set of rules amounts to. It amounts to certain choices. First of all, it amounts to the choice that the degrees of freedom underlying gravity are carried by the metric. It amounts to the choice of a certain Bayer action, the Einstein-Hilbert term, plus a cosmological constant perhaps, which is not really crucial here. And it amounts to a certain calculational method, which is perturbation theory, but more than that, it's a set of rules of how to deal with the infinities you encounter in your calculations. This set of rules is basically the same we apply for decades by now to standard matter field theories, or in modern language, it would be the statement that you try to take, or you take the infinite cutoff limit of this theory at the so-called Gaussian fixed point. I will explain in a moment what this really means. Now, this box here summarizes the approach which has led to this conclusion that the quantum theory we obtain is merely an effective one. So if you want to get around this conclusion, you have to change something, and the various proposals for quantum theories of gravity, they make different proposals as to what needs to be changed. For instance, string theory changes basically everything, the degrees of freedom. There are many more, not just the metric, all sorts of other matter-like degrees of freedom. The action is different, and the calculational method, of course, is also different. Loop quantum gravity changes the degrees of freedom, the calculational method, as a consequence of that, but the Einstein-Hilbert action is kept in most approaches. Whereas asymptotic safety in this list is sort of a very conservative theory. It changes the calculational method in an essential way, and in a, I could call it, very mild way also the action. But what is kept from the classical theory is the carrier field of the degrees of freedom. So in a nutshell, the essential properties of the asymptotic safety approach are the degrees of freedom are still assumed to be supported, to be carried by the metric tensor field, but in contrast to the perturbative renormalization scheme I mentioned before, the quantization of the theory or the renormalization of the theory is in a very essential way non-perturbative. So the calculational scheme is crucially non-perturbative. I told you the action is not determined a priori. It's not quite precisely the Einstein-Hilbert action. In fact, the action in this approach, the bare action, is a prediction in this setting. Namely, the bare action is obtained as a fixed point, a so-called non-Gaussian fixed point of a certain Wilsonian renormalization group flow. I'm going to tell you in a moment what this is supposed to be in more detail. Then, once you have set up this, or if you have formulated what this flow is, then you can look for fixed points of it. And what you find, I will show you some evidence, is the fixed point is of the structure Einstein-Hilbert term plus correction terms, higher derivatives, and also non-local terms. Now, if such a fixed point really should exist, then it has the advantage that it can be used to, using Jan Ampion's language of yesterday, to take the continuum limit of the theory at this fixed point, which in perturbative language would mean that in a certain sense it controls the divergences and it avoids this non-predictivity associated with the perturbative scheme. Now, I should make the same remark here as Jan yesterday, if it exists. So the crucial question is, does there exist a suitable fixed point in the corresponding space of actions? Well, the idea that perhaps gravity can be renormalized non-perturbatively along such lines is a rather old one. It was proposed back in 1979 by Steven Weinberg, and he coined this term asymptotic safety for this approach. And indeed, in 2 plus epsilon dimensions, he could show that at least for the Newton constant, there does exist a fixed point which has just the right properties to make the theory non-perturbatively renormalizable. But then there was, for quite some time, there was no real progress, because in 4 dimensions there was no technical tool you could apply. Here it was the epsilon expansion. Things changed a bit in the early 90s when, first of all, for flat space theories, so-called exact renormalization group equations were developed. One of them, the the flow equation for the so-called effective average action, a concept I'm also going to introduce in a moment, introduced by Christoph Wetterich. And this notion of an infinite dimensional flow equation, that turned out to be a very useful tool to investigate this notion of an infinite dimensional flow, which was behind Weinberg's proposal in a non-perturbative context in 4 dimensions. So what is this effective average action? Well, first of all, it's a kind of coarse-grained free energy, functional coarse-grained in the Wilsonian sense. You can think of it as arising from a path integral which contains a certain constraint on the momenta or on the momenta, on the modes you have integrated out. What you do is you introduce an infrared cutoff at a certain variable scale, little k, and then you integrate out all fluctuation modes, quantum fluctuations or statistical fluctuations is not important for the time being. You integrate out all fluctuation modes down to that infrared cutoff. And you do that by introducing a certain mass term, in quotes and quotes, a mass term for your fluctuations, which is designed in such a way that it suppresses the low frequency modes and allows for an unobstructed integration of the high frequency modes. And with this modified path integral, you can define an object gamma k, which is in many respects analogous to the standard effective action. And in fact, for k going to zero, when you send this infrared cutoff to zero, what you recover is just the ordinary effective action. Whereas when k is sent to infinity, you get essentially, that's not quite true, this equality sign, but the difference is not important for the present purposes. You get essentially the classical or more appropriate Bayer action. So the nice point about this scheme is that it translates the problem of computing and making well-defined a functional integral, it translates that problem into solving a certain flow equation or exact RG equation of this symbolic structure. This is a differential equation on the space of action functionals gamma k. And what this equation tells you is how this functional, this running action, if you like, how it changes as you change the infrared cutoff k. So this gamma 2 here on the right-hand side is the Hessian of gamma. So this is a closed equation for this functional. If you solve it subject to this initial condition, then you can compute gamma, and then you know everything you would like to know. So in quotes and quotes, solving the theory is equivalent to solving this equation. So you can imagine how difficult it is to do that exactly. It's impossible. But there is a very natural approximation scheme which comes with this reformulation of the problem. Namely, the idea is to truncate the space in which this functional gamma k lives. You can project this flow onto some nice and hopefully physically important subspace, and if that subspace is appropriately chosen, you can have the hope that it encapsulates the essential physics in a finite dimensional setting. So this is the general scheme, and during the past 15 years it has been applied to very many problems in particle physics, statistical mechanics, and so on. And as I told you, it has a natural generalization to gravity, but there are certain points which make gravity a very special problem, and this is the only formal transparency I'm showing you today, and I quickly want to go through the construction of this functional in the concrete case of gravity. The a priori formal starting point of the construction is a formal path integral over all matrix, Bayer matrix, you could say gamma mu nu, S is some Bayer action, diffeomorphism invariant. Then the first step is you decompose this integration variable gamma into a fixed background metric G bar plus a fluctuation. But no expansion in this H mu nu is implied. This is just a decomposition, but it's not an expansion in powers of H mu nu. Then you add a standard background gauge fixing term plus its ghost action. And then the crucial step making it a running action is you expand the fluctuation in terms of the d bar squared eigenmodes, that is the eigenmodes of the covariant Laplacian constructed from this background metric. And then you introduce a cutoff by means of these mass-like terms which suppress the integration of all modes with eigenvalues smaller, with d bar squared eigenvalues smaller than k squared. So this is the covariant version of a coarse graining a la Wilson. And the rest is more or less standard. Then you couple two sources. You obtain in this way a generating functional dual Legendre transform, and in this manner you obtain the gamma k I was talking about, which however has a somewhat unusual property, namely it depends on two different metrics. First of all, it depends on the variable you expect, namely the expectation value of the microscopic metric, that's g, but it also depends parametrically on the background g bar I had chosen. That was a completely unspecified arbitrary background. It never gets fixed, and also on the ghosts. Then from this path integral construction, you can derive the actual form of the exact normalization group equations of the type I showed you before, and you can verify from the path integral construction these limits. Gamma infinity is S and gamma zero is the standard one. Now what we are exploiting here is in particular the standard old De Witt-like background gauge technique. So that means if you in the end equate G bar and G, or stated differently, you put the fluctuation average to zero, then you end up with a, you could call it ordinary action, which generates an admissible set of Green's functions of your theory. And by construction, this object is covariant under diffeomorphisms applied to all the fields, and this is a functional depending on only one metric in a diffeomorphism invariant way, because both the gauge fixing and the cutoff are background gauge invariant. Okay, that is the setting, and now I would like to more or less resume Jan's discussion from yesterday on taking a continuum limit or constructing a microscopic quantum theory in that language. Now I just would like to do in sort of pictorial terms by means of this cartoon here, what this potato is supposed to indicate is the so-called theory space. Theory space is the space of all actions of a given symmetry type here, actions depending on G and G bar and being diffeomorphism invariant. And everything is expressed in dimensionless units, made dimensionless by means of the cutoff K. So a certain point here is an action, and the space here, what is indicated in yellow, this space consists of well-defined actions. So the actions outside here are, in this pictorial language, they are sort of thick. They develop infinities in some of the components. So on that space, you have various geometrical structures, and the most important one is a vector field. This vector field beta is defined by the right-hand side of the flow equation, and the integral curves through this vector field are the renormalization group trajectories provided by your flow equation. Now, in this setting, it is very easy to understand what it means to sort of rigorously define a quantum field theory, or what it means to solve the both infrared and ultraviolet renormalization problem. What it means is the task is you have to construct an infinitely long trajectory extending from k equals zero to k equals infinity, a trajectory that is infinitely long but never leaves the space of regular actions. So every naive attempt at doing that when you send k to infinity, for instance, would result in typically in an action which develops divergences. So in this cartoon here, the trajectory would leave the space. So the task is you must control this trajectory for an infinite amount of renormalization group time. That is just a fancy word for the log of k. Now the basic idea of asymptotic safety is something very simple. Namely, the idea is you have to use up an infinitely long time. And what's the easiest way to do that? The easiest way is you let the trajectory run into a fixed point, then it doesn't move anymore. You can use up an infinite amount of time there, and you are sure the trajectory doesn't do strange things in the sense of going outside the space of allowed actions. So this is the key idea. If this trajectory for k going to infinity runs into a fixed point denoted gamma star here, if that is chosen as the bare action, then you are sure the theory is safe from unphysical or unwanted singularities in the ultraviolet. That is the reason for the name asymptotic safety. So, as I said, now the key question is there such a fixed point? And as I also mentioned already, to look for this flow or for such a fixed point in the space of all actions is a hopelessly difficult task. So what you do is you try to project the flow onto some finite dimensional subspace and hope to get some impression about the flow pattern in the big infinite dimensional space. So the first sort of truncation or truncated or projected calculation I tried was this Einstein-Hilbert truncation, where you do nothing but take the Einstein-Hilbert action with the cosmological term, but allow Newton's constant and the cosmological constant to depend on the scale k. Now the next step is you insert this ansatz into the right-hand side of the flow equation, and you derive equations for these two functions, g of k and lambda of k, the running Newton constant and the running cosmological constant. More precisely or more conveniently, what you do is you derive equations for the dimension less Newton constant, little g, and the dimension less cosmological constant, little lambda, in d dimensions that differ here by a power k to the d minus 2 and 1 over k squared. So it's these dimensionless quantities, made dimensionless by means of the cutoff, which should yield a scaling solution, or which should assume fixed point values. Now, doing this calculation, inserting this ansatz into the exact equation, you can derive a set of two coupled equations for little g and little lambda with certain simple computable beta functions, beta g and beta lambda. And now you can look what is the properties of this system of coupled equations. Now I'm not showing you the formulas, just let me show you the picture one finds in just in four dimensions. Namely, this is the flow pattern on the two-dimensional truncated theory space. Here this is the dimensionless Newton constant, this is the dimensionless cosmological constant. The negative part here, the lower half plane, is not really important. The upper half plane consists of essentially three different classes of trajectories. Some of them run towards negative values of the cosmological constant. The arrow, in the sense of increasing coarse graining, always runs from higher to lower scales. So it points, the arrows point towards the infrared. And, well, the most exciting discovery, of course, is that this flow does really possess a non-Gaussian fixed point of the required, with the required properties. This is a Gaussian one at vanishing g and lambda. This is more or less the one on which perturbation theory is based. And this other one is at positive lambda, at positive g, and it has the property that wherever you start at a certain scale in the upper half plane, say here, if you go from low to high energies, you are always attracted into this fixed point and you spiral into the fixed point. So this is what asymptotic safety means. When you go to higher energies, you know where you end up and you don't run out of the space of controlled finite parameter values. Now you could rightfully argue that this is just a truncation out of infinitely many invariants. We just kept two in this approximation, but during the past 5 or 6 years, a lot of reliability tests based on universality arguments or on generalized truncations have been performed, and now it seems that it is really more or less certain that this fixed point really exists on the big untruncated full theory space. There are so many algebraic and numerical miracles going on in these calculations which would remain completely unexplained if there was not this fixed point as an organizing principle behind them. For instance, just a few weeks ago there was a calculation by Roberto Percacci and his collaborators was published where they kept up to terms with the curvature scalar up to the 7th power, and even this enormously complicated calculation fully confirms this simple picture. So for the rest of this talk, let me assume this fixed point is there in the exact theory, and let's try to understand some of the properties of the theory which results from defining the continuum limit at this fixed point. So usually we abbreviate this theory by quantum Einstein gravity, where this word Einstein is to refer to the fact that, as Einstein proposed, we use the metric as the carrier field, but it's not the Einstein-Hilbert action which is sort of singled out. Now here is a list of some properties of this approach. One property is that the construction I described to you is in a certain sense background independent, namely in the sense that no special metric plays any distinguished role. And the way how this is achieved is quite precisely by using a background decomposition, namely the strategy is you fix a completely arbitrary unspecified background G bar, then you quantize the nonlinear fluctuations, this H mu nu's in that background, and then you require that they don't acquire a vacuum expectation value, so setting the expectation value of the fluctuation to zero is just what I told you is this recipe in the background technique. You put G equals to G bar. So this in a way adjusts the background dynamically. It is used as a tool to quantize the theory, but it's never specified by hand. So this is one aspect of background independence. There is another issue which is a bit reminiscent of background independence, but in a very different context, namely, it's also true that no specific action functional a priori plays any distinguished role. It's not as in standard quantum field theory, you are given an action and you quantize that dynamics. This action, the bare action or gamma star, is a prediction. Now you could ask, what's the input to this theory? How are you telling the equations that you want to do gravity and not pionucleon physics or something like that? Well, the only input is you specify the field contents of the theory, the arguments your functional depends on, and you specify the symmetries, diffeomorphism invariants in that case. And in this way you get a theory space, and the theory space implies a flow equation, and the flow equation implies, if it exists, a fixed point, which in turn tells you what is the bare action. So Einstein-Hilbert at a conceptual level does not seem to play any distinguished role, but in all the calculations done so far, it always appears that at least numerically, it seems to be quite a reliable approximation for most purposes. Right. Implicitly, it always refers to a state, but to the accuracy we did the calculation till now, there is no state dependence visible yet. But as you go to the full flow, in particular towards the infrared, that will enter. So there are various aspects of this. Of this scenario are quite well understood. Others are quite open questioned, as for instance this state dependence. What is sort of well understood is this combination of the average action philosophy with the background method. This has been tested in many calculations in electrodynamics or Yang-Mills theory, where you reproduce all the perturbative results and you can extend them towards into the non-perturbative domain. What is more interesting now is this theory, if you define it like that, of course it has, in a certain regime, it has to reproduce the successes of classical general relativity. And in fact, I will show you on the next transparency an example, there do exist renormalization group trajectories which indeed have a very long regime where basically nothing happens, where the capital G and capital lambda do not change as a function of K. So gravity is classical. This is true in a certain regime for some trajectories, but not generically. Generically, there is no classical world. In this classical regime, then most probably it also makes sense to apply the well-known semi-classical discussions, for instance, on quantum field theory and curved space-time, for instance, the derivation of Hawking radiation and so on. Another point which is in principle well understood is this coexistence of the perturbative non-renormalizability on the one side and the non-perturbative renormalizability on the other side. There are simple, you could call them toy models, where this has been studied long ago. For instance, various versions of the Gross-Neveu model have the same features, and there you can study nicely these issues. Another remark I would like to make is that it seems that according to all that is known about coupling matter to gravity and investigating the fixed point in that context, is that there seems to be no preferred or no special set of matter fields you need to impose in order to get these nice or benign high energy properties. There is no need to fine-tune the matter multiplets in any way or to impose any specific restrictions, or in particular supersymmetry or something like that seems not to be needed. And also, contrary to many claims, there is absolutely no need, most probably, to unify gravity with the other forces to get this ultraviolet behavior. Now let me be a bit more specific about the point of what is the structure of the trajectories which have a long classical regime. In particular, what is the structure of the renormalization group trajectory which would describe our real world under the hypothesis that the Einstein-Hilbert approximation is a good approximation. Now I will postulate that this is a good approximation, and then I can follow the same steps as in quantum electrodynamics, for instance. I measure two parameters, and then this tells me which one of the infinitely many available trajectories which one is realized in nature. And the one which we find in this way is depicted here. The two parameters are, of course, Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. Well, first of all, astrophysicists tell us the cosmological constant is positive, so it's one of these trajectories which run towards the right. And if you insert numbers, what you get is, under the assumption that the matter system doesn't change the pure gravity behavior too much, then you find G star, lambda star values, the fixed point values of order 1. The turning point of this trajectory is, on the other hand, at incredibly tiny values of 10 to the minus 60 about each. And then you turn around and you ultimately approach a certain critical value of little lambda, namely 1/2. This 1/2 is critical in the sense that at that point the Einstein-Hilbert truncation breaks down. You cannot continue within this approximation beyond this point. That's a sort of familiar phenomenon. Also in Young-Mills theory you have the same phenomenon. It just tells you that the approximation is too simple, and most probably you should include other invariants into your equation, non-local ones in particular. Now, what is quite interesting is if you look, what is the scale parameter k at the various points of this trajectory? Well, here, this is the Gaussian, the non-Gaussian fixed point. This crossing over scale is more or less the Planck mass. K is m Planck, or k to the minus 1 l Planck. The turning point is at an inverse k of 10 to the minus 3 centimeters. And then finally, down here, you can check that when, well, at a little g of 10 to the minus 70 down to 10 to the minus 120, say, in this regime between the points P1 and P2, there you have basically no running of the physical g and the physical lambda. So the classical world along this trajectory is here, whereas up here you have very strong renormalization effects. It also could be that here close to that critical point there are again strong renormalization effects. There are indications that Newton's constant starts increasing here. It might be that this leads to a modification of gravity at large distances, perhaps mimicking dark matter. This issue is not completely or not fully settled yet, but for the talk today we shall just be concerned with this region here of the trajectory, and it will not matter what happens here. So the scales are, this is somewhere solar system scale, galaxies, cosmology here. Things might become a bit difficult and at the same time very intriguing. On the next transparencies, I show you again in the language of the dimension full quantities, what is the scale dependence of the dimension full cosmological constant. Well, this is k, here is the Planck mass, this is the turning point scale in the millielectron volt range, and this is the present Hubble parameter. Here the dotted line means we don't quite know what happens, but that's not important today. So this is the classical regime, lambda is constant. At the scale of electron volts, say, lambda starts increasing with the fourth power of the scale, and then at the Planck mass it switches to the fixed point running, the dimensionless lambda equals lambda star, this is constant, and the dimension full one runs quadratically. In this so-called k to the fourth regime, this is actually what you get by naively summing the zero-point energies of free harmonic oscillators. Nothing specific, nothing exciting happens to Newton's constant, but in the Planck regime above the Planck mass it goes down like 1 over k squared. I also should say that in this talk what I call Planck length and mass and time and so on is always defined with this plateau value, the value of Newton's constant in our classical world. So now the most interesting question is, what you see here is that between the Planck mass and this electron volt scale, lambda changes by this famous, notorious 120 orders of magnitude. And the question I'm going to ask now is if there is any trace of this enormous scale dependence in our observations we have made already, and in particular made in cosmology. So the question is, are there observable, and more than that, perhaps even observed physical phenomena which we possibly could relate to this enormous, absolutely tremendous scale dependence of the cosmological constant? Now what I'm going to argue in the following is that perhaps the entropy carried by the cosmological matter, in particular the entropy of the background photons, might be entirely due to this phenomenon of a scale-dependent cosmological constant. You all know this famous puzzle. If you look into the if you compute the entropy of just the photon, the background photons inside a Hubble sphere, the present Hubble sphere, you end up with a number of something like 10 to the 88 in natural units of K. Boltzmann. On the other hand, most people would consider it much more natural that this is what we have today. This is one statement. The other statement is standard Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology is based upon an adiabatic evolution. So the standard cosmology does not change the co-moving entropy. So the question is, if you have the prejudice, and I think it's a well-founded prejudice, and from many points of view that would be the most natural choice, if you have this prejudice that the very early universe, soon after the Big Bang, is an entropy of order 1 or 0, actually. You somehow should explain where this enormous amount of entropy in the present universe comes from. And I'm going to argue that this amount of entropy could be explained by nothing but the running of lambda without any standard dissipative processes. Then another thing which is sort of natural is, you all know, a positive lambda tries to accelerate the universe. So what one could think of happening is something like an inflation, which is driven by the cosmological constant as long as it is large, and then it dynamically, just by the renormalization group running, it becomes smaller and stops automatically. Without any inflaton and all these complicated structures you need in standard inflation. Now, of course, inflation is not something we have observed in any direct way, but in a sense it helps in understanding the structures, the seeds for the structure formations, and this connects to my third point, namely the primordial density perturbations, which were the seeds of the structures we observe today in cosmology. They might be a reflection of very specific properties of the non-Gaussian fixed point. Basically, what one can argue is that the Big Bang, or perhaps not the Big Bang, but the very early universe, is a kind of critical phenomenon which naturally leads to a scale-invariant spectrum of fluctuations. Now let me show you a bit more precisely what is the idea of this entropy generation by the running of lambda. Well, a very direct way of extracting physical informations from the RG flow is to identify the scale with some natural geometrical quantity, something like the Hubble parameter, for instance. I will not make any specific choice for now, just let me assume a cutoff identification of this kind. As the cosmological time increases, the scale decreases monotonically. Let's just assume that, and let's assume we are sitting on such a trajectory below this spiraling regime. Then if you evaluate lambda at this identified scale, you get a function of time. And just two features you can read off from this setting immediately, namely, this is a positive function and it is decreasing as a function of time. And now you can easily convince yourself that positive and decreasing has the impact of sort of pumping energy into the matter system, whatever it is. There is an energy transfer into the matter system. The most primitive way to see that is look at the Sitter space plus a test particle. This is the metric. This is the function phi n here minus 1/6 lambda r squared. If you interpret this metric in a Newtonian way, you would say this is the Newtonian potential for a particle sitting at distance r from the origin. Now, this curve for a positive lambda is an upside-down parabola. For positive lambda, it's upside down. So when you decrease the magnitude of lambda, when you decrease the magnitude of a positive lambda, this lifts up that curve, which means the potential energy of that Newtonian particle gets increased. So that would be a first prediction just from the topology of these trajectories, inflow of energy into the matter system. And this phenomenon you can investigate at various levels of sophistications. What we did here is, for instance, to discuss the same phenomenon in a sort of hydrodynamics language, which is as it is usually used in cosmology. Let's assume we specify a spatially flat Robertson-Walker geometry with this metric, this energy momentum tensor, and then write down the effective field equations or the RG improved field equations, namely those with the time dependent lambda and time dependent G, with the time dependence obtained by inserting some as to yet unspecified cutoff identifications. Then what you get is this kind of modified Friedmann equation. It looks like the usual one, except that you have the time dependence here, and you get, as another Einstein equation, you get a modified conservation law. The blue part equals to zero is the standard one, and this right-hand side is new. It involves the change of lambda and G. And this equation now describes the transfer of energy from the vacuum, represented by these fields, now they are fields, lambda and G, into the matter system. Now this system of equations had been analyzed a while ago already with Alfio Bonanno and Frank Sauer-Essig for the specific case that there is no energy exchange between the two, separate conservation and separate conservation of vacuum energy, if you want to call it like that. And what I'm going to describe now in the last minutes is what changes when you allow for a completely unconstrained, unrestricted exchange of energy. And the main new feature is just this entropy generation. Namely, this is the Friedmann equation rewritten in a way which is almost familiar, except for the right-hand side. This P tilde involves the time derivatives of lambda and G, and it's well known how to interpret it. Let's look at a unit co-moving volume of the cosmological fluid. It has this proper volume, contains this energy and this entropy. This little s is the proper entropy density. Then this is your new conservation law, and just comparing to the first law, you conclude that P tilde is something like temperature times the change of the co-moving entropy. In the classical case, it is zero. You have an adiabatic expansion. Whereas in the improved case, you really can generate entropy if this quantity is non-zero. Now, up to now, I was talking about energy exchange, but if you want to interpret that as an entropy production or entropy change, you must know something about the thermodynamics of your cosmological fluid. This is the entropy production rate, and what appears here is the temperature. And to go on now, you must know what is temperature in terms of pressure and entropy density. And what we did here is to invent a kind of minimal scenario where the adiabaticity of the standard model expansion is changed as little as possible. There is work by Lima of 10 years ago who has investigated such almost adiabatic cosmologies. And what we postulated basically is that the matter system consists of massless particles with the equation of state of radiation and also rho temperature, the energy density temperature relation is the standard one, of equilibrium thermodynamics. This is the postulate. All what is in this box seems to be very familiar to you, but these are the relations for equilibrium thermodynamics, and the postulate is we weakly, very weakly disturb equilibrium only and assume that this continues to be true in this out-of-equilibrium situation. And note, we make no assumption about the entropy density. And now some very remarkable little algebraic miracle happens, namely, if you compute this production rate, for T you insert rho to the 1/4 and for the pressure rho over 3, then after a few lines you discover that this quantity is a total derivative. You can integrate it, get this equation for the integrated total entropy in terms of the energy density, or for the proper density you get this expression. SC is a free constant of integration. For the solutions which are most relevant to us, this vanishes at the Big Bang, so this constant is the value at early times. Now the remarkable coincidence is this formula up to this point, this first part here, this is exactly the well-known relationship for the entropy density as a function of temperature, which you have in equilibrium thermodynamics. So what this equation tells you is if SC is zero, the entropy created due to this changing lambda is exactly what we observe today. Whatever it is, the entropy in the massless degrees of freedom is precisely the amount which is pumped into the matter system by the change of lambda. Now that was the most important feature of this free exchange. We can, of course, solve now the modified Einstein equations, at least numerically. We did that for a realistic trajectory and this specific cutoff identification, KSH basically. For the fixed point solution, in the fixed point, you can do this analytically. You get some nice power laws. Scale factor goes with a certain power alpha given in this way. The only free parameter is omega lambda star. This is the relative vacuum energy density in the fixed point regime. So you get a one parameter family of solutions with the following properties. If omega lambda is in the range between 1/2 and 1, you have an exponent alpha larger than 1. You have an accelerated expansion, power law inflation, you could call it. Omega lambda is larger than omega m. You have a positive entropy production. You have no particle horizon, so this cosmology has no problem with no horizon problem. And for alpha very large, when omega lambda is close to 1, you get approximately a de Sitter phase. So the others are not so important. Just let me show you some plots. This is the plot of the RG trajectory, sort of, in quotes, realized in nature. What we have here is this GT value, KT 10 to the minus 30 M Planck, and this variable tau is the log of K. Now, what you have here is the curve again on G lambda space compared to this dashed line, which is the result of the linearization. Now, this is the curve lambda as a function of tau and this little g as a function of tau. What you see here on this logarithmic plot, you see very nicely that there is a very, very sharp transition between the Gaussian fixed point regime, that is where the linearization about the Gaussian fixed point is valid, and the non-Gaussian fixed point regime where g and lambda are constant. What is plotted here is the anomalous dimension, that is the logarithmic derivative of Newton's constant at the Gaussian fixed point. It's 0, it's minus 2 at the non-Gaussian. So you have a very clear signal of a crossover. So that's just the trajectory. And this crossover now gets translated to the cosmology. What is shown here is the solution, the numerical solution to the cosmological equations here for 1/2. You have a clear, I should say, this quantity U plotted here is the log of the Hubble parameter, whereas X is the log of the scale factor. So this is Hubble versus scale factor. And what you see here is a very clear crossover phenomenon again. Here you have basically the analytically available non-Gaussian fixed point solution, and here a classical FRW solution with no essential cosmological constant. This is omega lambda as a function of the scale factor. It goes from 1 to 0. This is the deceleration parameter. This is again the curve on the G lambda plane, and this diamond here indicates the place where the crossover happens. So this, at this point, you are more or less at K equals M Planck, where the dip here in the anomalous dimension occurs. And finally, the last plot is precisely the entropy production rate. What is plotted here is P, and if you look at the abscissa here, the peak is precisely at the crossover. It's more or less near K equals M Planck that there is an enormous push of entropy which is pumped into the matter system. Before and after, there is essentially no essential inflow of entropy. Okay, just one transparency, and everybody knows what it is supposed to indicate. Namely, we have a power law inflation before the transition from classical to the fixed point regime. What is plotted here in blue is the Hubble scale, and in black, the proper length of any structure of a fixed co-moving length. And very much as in standard inflation, whatever is whatever in the early stage is below the Hubble scale crosses the Hubble scale at a certain moment. I emphasize that because what I mentioned in the introduction, there is a very natural way of creating a scale-free spectrum of primordial density perturbations, and that's just natural because we are dealing with a fixed point. In statistical physics intuition, you should think of a kind of critical phenomenon, and a natural idea would be, you say, what we observe, or what was the seeds for the observed structures, was somehow a decohered, decohered quantum fluctuations, but quantum fluctuations of what? And what we propose is of geometry itself. And if you postulate that the primordial density perturbations are somehow proportional to the curvature-curvature two-point function, then using nothing but fixed-point properties, you can deduce a certain behavior, how it depends on x, and this you can translate into a spectral index for the power spectrum. And the nice point is, what you get for the delta rho power spectrum is exactly n equals 1 or Harrison-Seldovich-like scale-free spectrum below, for modes below the Hubble scale. And now, of course, if you combine this fact with the fact that the modes cross the Hubble scale, you could think of generating this spectrum at an early time below the Hubble scale. I never call it horizon, that's not a horizon. And because of this crossing, you could think of basically the same mechanism as in standard inflation, namely that these small fluctuations become large and super Hubble-sized by means of this method. And one can show, I'm not going into the details now, you can show that this is possible without any fine tuning, that is sort of generic, that you could get this famous 60E folds without any fine tuning of our only free parameter, namely omega lambda star. So the conclusion is that it is perhaps worthwhile, even if these are just very preliminary and still sketchy investigations, it is perhaps worthwhile to look into possible cosmological implications of these particular features of asymptotically safe gravity. And I think the message is, one should not necessarily think that these quantum gravity effects are somehow tiny effects, Planck suppressed little effects, but possibly it is something we have seen already and is sort of macroscopic. And this entropy business and the question of primordial density perturbations might be candidates of such already observed phenomena one possibly could explain in this manner. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this really thought-provoking talk. Lots of ideas. Unfortunately, we are already over the time, including the discussion session. So let's take one question.
Yes, I just have a question on a memory of your talk, which you kind of skipped through, but I think it seems very interesting. And that is, I want to see if I understood you right, basically. So, it seems to me that what you said means that you basically, if the theory is right, you basically solve the problem of the smallness of the cosmological constant, and that it's possible to identify the cosmological constant is being the vacuum energy of the field, because when we look at QFT, we see a bigger cosmological constant because of the running at small scales, and then at cosmological scales it falls, gets diminished by a factor of 10 to the
yes. I mean, this is a very good question. I mean, what does it mean to solve the cosmological constant problem? Some people would like to solve it in the sense they would like to have an argument which explains why it is small. I have no argument which explains why it is small. And I am not curing this fine-tuning problem. I am just saying, if I take the observed value of lambda and of g, I get a RG trajectory which is highly non-generic, and the highly non-generic nature appears at that turning point coordinates 10 to the minus 60, 10 to the minus 60. If you use this highly non-generic trajectory, then you get this small macroscopic cosmological constant. And this is the standard situation in quantum field theory. QED does not tell you what is the mass of the electron, and it does not tell you what is the value of the fine structure constant. But if you measure them, then you get the trajectory and can do all sorts of other predictions. And the same is here. This just studying the trajectories, it does not tell you why lambda is small. You use it as an input parameter to pick the right trajectory.
But the important thing is that you allow the identification of the vacuum energy field with the cosmology.
Yes, yes. I mean, there is this famous statement everybody keeps repeating, that this 120 orders of magnitude is the most misleading or the wrongest prediction ever made in physics. I think if one calls this a prediction, then this is like confusing in quantum electrodynamics, it's like confusing the bare and the renormalized mass. And of course, the bare mass of the electron is infinity or something like that. And so I just think you have to appreciate there is a difference between bare and renormalized quantities. And well, the lambda at the Planck scale is somewhere in between. And they are just different, and they are enormously different. But I think your question was, can I explain why it is so small? I mean, a RG proof or argument why it has to be small would be something like discovering an infrared fixed point such that when the trajectory flows into that, it is forced to have zero or small cosmological constant. That's a logical possibility, but there is nothing proven in that direction as to yet.
And this is really the top working topic, and lots of questions I know people are ready to answer. But we have started 30 minutes late, we get done, but now we are 25 minutes late, we are going to be done to solve. So this completely is this time. Thank you very much.